actually sued Red Robin because he went there and he bit into their burger and there was a nail in it.
Oh my goodness.
And he like chipped his tooth and
yeah.
Morning.
Yeah. Why? Anybody?
I got Robin. He bit and there was
a
nail.
You know what burger he got?
The nail burger. Yeah, yeah. No, I remember having a frozen burger there once. It was kind of like bit into it. It was like frozen.
Like a hammer.
A nail, a real nail. Yeah. Once I went with my kids. Did anybody go to like a bread factory when they were in K-12? I once joined my kids at a bread factory in Snyder's Bread Factory, which you might want to go to sometime. And the guy was advertising how if a piece of metal got into the loaf, there'd be this cool machine that would just like detect it and blast air at it and blow the loaf off the conveyor belt. And so all the kids were just like, wow, we gotta see this. And he had this hunk of metal, and he stuck it in the loaf, and it goes by on the conveyor belt, and nothing happens. And it's one of those moments where kids look at you like, another disappointing adult. Another adult who just kind of tells you something, and it turns out not to be true. But finding nails in your food and stuff, I guess that's a feature of industrial food. Can happen anyway. Okay, anything else? So the Carl's Jr. thing is kind of interesting. I need to formally apologize for suggesting that Carl's Jr. didn't make its biscuits from scratch. In fact, they do. They make them from pretty basic ingredients, nominally. It's really the Hardee's biscuit, which had originally Carl's Jr. did it. I couldn't find the commercial. My colleagues are kind of wondering about me. I'm sitting in my office watching Carl's Jr. commercials. But there was one that was supposed to be very tasteful, involving a Southern gentleman and these biscuits. And so they branded it according to a food culture. So that's kind of a neat thing to notice, I guess. But the thing about the Carl's Jr. biscuit is that we're going to talk about it a little bit today. It's still an industrial product. So when you say made from scratch, they actually do make them from scratch. In other words, somebody gets a bowl out, and they actually get their hands into a bowl of flour and buttermilk and sugar, and so I was impressed with that. It's kind of cool. They actually roll it out, and so it's actually the method for the food is from scratch, but the materials are white flour. We're going to talk about it today because that comes up in pollen, right? And the buttermilk is, well, it's an industrial version of buttermilk. I couldn't get a definitive answer, but there's ways to get buttermilk naturally, and there's ways to get buttermilk artificially. As far as I could tell, it was mostly a flavor thing. So they could use enzymes that speed up the process, because the traditional way to get buttermilk, you have to kind of wait for the butter and milk to separate. It's the byproduct of butter manufacture, which I learned for the first time. So the thing about the biscuit is that it's a just kind of take a look at it nutritionally. It's a 300. Oh, by the way, you can't buy the biscuit by itself. It's not a. I'm going to show you this one here from our website. You can only buy it in combination with other things. Let's see. Okay. So what was this one? So this was a guy who I trusted just as he actually gave a favorable review of the biscuit on flavor grounds, but he gave a negative review of what you could actually buy, because you couldn't buy the biscuit by itself. And I thought he was a pretty authoritative looking eater there. You know, he looks like he knows his food. So that was an interesting data point. It kind of made me kind of wonder about it. So here's the video.
This is real buttermilk. And when you mix it with flour, it makes real biscuit dough, which is where real biscuits come from. This is made from scratch.
The Mile High Bacon, Egg, and Cheese biscuit with thick-cut applewood smoked bacon.
So it's kind of a mixed news, right? They are made from scratch. There was another food journalist who had done an article. She went into the store and she did what they did, and it looks pretty much like that. So I stand corrected. It's the two things I would comment on. One is that you can't buy it like that. You have to buy it like this. You have to buy it with other stuff in it. Although I think they originally marketed it, I think 2011 is when they started doing it in Carl's Jr. And so this, if you could buy it by yourself, it would be a 300-calorie biscuit with 15 grams of fat and 730 grams of milligrams of sodium. That's a huge amount of sodium. This is a biscuit that's about this big by this big. 36 grams of carbs and 5 grams of protein. Okay, so if you compare that to like a muffin that you might make from whole ingredients, from butter, real butter, and everything. So this is leaving aside the fact that there's zero fiber in this, right? So you could have there's a muffin that I make that has 11 grams of fat, almost the same number of calories, 11 grams of fat, zero sodium, 26 grams of carbs, so not too uncomparable, and then 12 grams of protein. So what you have in the Carl's Jr. Biscuit is a zero fiber, high sugar, because these carbs are mostly, they're all refined carbs, and there's added sugar. So a zero fiber, high sugar, high fat, low protein biscuit. Kind of interesting. So you can get, flavor-wise, I'm told, I haven't had one, but flavor-wise, I'm told that they're actually pretty good. And there is a Hardee's recipe that you could look up and make, people will say, well, this is the recipe that most closely approximates the one. So, but the one you buy in the store is gonna be like that, and it's gonna have like several kinds of meat on it maybe, and or animal protein, and it's gonna be 830 calories, right? And it's gonna have 60 grams of fat. This is a real bomb. 2 grams of sodium. That's a lot of sodium in one little sandwich. That's an amazing amount of sodium, actually. We'll look at dietary guidelines for this all later. But it will pack a lot of protein. It'll have, because of the meat and the egg, it'll have 31 grams of protein, which is a hell of a lot of protein. So do you see the kind of, we still need to talk about the ingredients. They'll come up in connection with today's readings. But this is a good example of a kind of set of trade-offs that you could have with an industrial food product that could legitimately be called made from scratch, right? So it can echo the quality that's associated with made from scratch. Okay, any questions about this? This is a lot of calories. If you're starting your day with this, that's amazing. 2 grams of sodium. Okay. Okay, was there anything else about Carl's Jr.? Let's see. There's the recipe there. Oh, yeah, the vegetable shortening is a little bit of an issue. This is the nutritional profile on the vegetable shortening. This doesn't mean this is Carl Jr.'s. They might use one that has... you guys should try to... How many of you are used to seeing a nutrition page like this? It's kind of a good thing to try. Nutrition Data Self is a Condé Nast site that... probably has one of the most sophisticated ways of presenting nutrition data. So a fat like that, all the calories are from fat. It's got saturated fat, trans fat. So I would be surprised if the vegetable shortening that Carl's Jr. used had trans fat in it. So this is just, I'm just showing you kind of a generic nutrition profile for a vegetable shortening. But I think you could probably, I don't know, I think you could probably make it without trans fat. Anyway, okay, any questions about that? Yeah, I just encourage you to keep looking into your environment, try to notice things like the made-from-scratch thing. I think it's an occasion to practice critical food skills, and that's kind of what we're trying to do. Right? Okay. Well, let's go ahead and get into our material for today. I hadn't planned a small group experience, but maybe one will come up. Maybe we'll just try and share... together a little bit about this. All right, so there's two things. Let's go ahead and start some notes. There's two things I wanted you to focus on today, and they showed up in the study questions. One is, what's pollen? The main event today, we should get right to it, is what's pollen's case against industrial food? And this is, again, the overview version, right? So later in the course, we're going to read some chapters from Michael Moss's book, Sugar, Salt, and Fat, which is a kind of an investigative journalist looking at the food industry. So we'll get a little more detail, but this is kind of I wanted you to have a quick version of the case against industrial food here, partly because some of you are considering doing the little diet improvement thing, and the second step of that is, I learned the right word for this, the second step in this diet improvement exercise that I'm working on is with you is, the correct word for the second step is actually an elimination diet. So knowing the case against industrial food, some of you, I'm inviting you to consider a small change in your diet, whether it's small or not, might depend on you. And one of the things you could do is eliminate industrial processed food. You could do something smaller by picking an industrial processed food like sugars, like sodas, to eliminate. But an elimination diet is a neat way to kind of start tinkering with your diet because it involves kind of keeping most things the same, kind of a low change threshold. But you can pick something that on the basis of your study you might want to kind of take out of your diet and see how that feels. Okay, any questions? You guys are quiet today. Is everything okay? Did you do okay on the quiz? Okay. I don't worry about you. Okay, so here's the... please, I want you guys to help me produce material here, Jim. I didn't send these books around. Sorry, before we get into that, just two things. These actually come up... we can make a connection here at the end of the pollen reading, but most cultures have many cultures have a definitive cookbook, or really usually a cookbook that defines national food culture. And so we have things like, Betty Crocker and The Joy of Cooking. And so I wanted to show you this. I can pull it up on here better, maybe. So this is a bit of a digression, but it's kind of under food news. So Amazon, Joy of Cooking. It's just kind of a small food culture thing here. That the cover, we need the original. Yeah, this is the original 1931 facsimile edition. And it's just a small food detail. I just think it's kind of interesting. That's St. Martha of Bethany. That should be a saint name here. So, the patron saint of cooking, slaying a dragon, the dragon of kitchen drudgery. The jacket blurb stresses the connection between the saint and the modern woman. Faced with almost tasks almost as diversified as St. Martha's, and cooking is not the least of the problems she must meet with intelligence and understanding. So this is an example of one of our national food culture recipes books, right? Cookbooks, and it's interesting to note that it's got this kind of cultural twist, oddly a religious twist, but. The theme is that cooking shouldn't be drudgery, that it should be... So it's announcing that modern food culture will be more fun. It won't be boring. You'll have a lot of appliances. You'll be able to make interesting foods. And in our food Bible, we actually have a really nice diversity of food. So this cookbook actually kind of exposed Americans to some simplified recipes from ethnic cuisine, and that also reflected the food culture of the U.S., right? I just think that's kind of a weird cover. For Italians, and I'll pass this one around, I haven't really done much with this book, so it's in great condition, but it's a real curiosity. Italians have their famous food, national food cookbook. It's called, it's by Artusi, Pellegrino Artusi, and it's called, in English, The Science in the Kitchen, The Art of Eating Well. And what he did was he brought together... culinary traditions from around Italy, which are really quite diverse and developed independently. So the idea is that he created a national food culture where there wasn't one by kind of bringing this together and saying, hey, we're all Italians, this is kind of our food. And that didn't exist before. Italians wouldn't have thought of themselves prior to, I think this is early 20th century. I'm sorry, I should know that. Italians wouldn't have thought of themselves as having a national food culture. So the point is just that cultures unify and articulate their food cultures partly by primary cookbooks, which wind up defining the national cuisine. So just pass this around in case you're curious about it while we're talking. Okay, now we've got to pollen. Okay. So pollen, the reason pollen starts this section with the Aborigines study is because this was one of the first studies that identified metabolic disorder, metabolic syndrome. And it's a syndrome. We don't really have a clear understanding of the causes, but it's associated with, I meant to look up the three things. It's associated with increased belly fat, insulin response, and I think there's a third. Could somebody look up metabolic syndrome and just get me the main factors that identify it? So it's a kind of, the point for your notes is that metabolic syndrome is a holistic disease of the diet. It seems to involve changing the direction of your metabolism in a way that's very hard or impossible to reverse. Do you have it?
High blood pressure. High blood sugar. The body fat.
And belly fat. Yeah, about midsection belly fat. For some reason, getting fat around there in connection with those other two factors has a kind of synergistic negative effect. So metabolic syndrome is one of the things that characterizes the Western diet. So that's why pollen starts with it. And again, it's neat, put it in your notes, it seems to be a holistic disease that's hard to pin down to a single cause in our diet. And remember his critique of nutritionism. So this would be a way of saying, well, if you're going to get beyond nutritionism, you need to look at diets holistically. That means you can see diseases holistically as well as effects. So again, not just a single factor. And then he takes you back into history, and I don't know what you guys thought about the Western price issue, but there were these intellectuals early in the 20th century who were big travelers, right? Can somebody recall some of the other names? There's some famous names on here. Albert Schweitzer, that's the one I recognize. I'm not sure what those other people are. These are early 20th century travelers, anthropologists, adventurers, and what they notice is that the populations they're visiting don't have the same diseases of diet that we have, right? And Weston notices this particularly in teeth. Now, he's an amateur, but he's one of the first people to try to collect epidemiological evidence globally, right? And did you like the detail about the Maasai teeth? Isn't that great? There might be green slime on their teeth, but underneath there's a really healthy tooth. That's great, isn't it? This is also a pretty neat section for reminding us what omnivores we are. You can have the Maasai eat mostly meat. So it's not like, again, we've said this before, it's not like there's only one kind of healthy diet for humans. And to some extent, humans adapt to their diet. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in this. So I don't want to say much about Albert Howard. We're going to be studying synthetic nitrogen fertilizer when we do a little history unit on food culture and history. This is a big moment in it's a great story, and it's a big moment in food history when in the 20th century we figured out how to get nitrogen out of the air, basically. And that was huge in the Green Revolution. So we'll cover that story in detail, but Albert Howard was one of the first people to make the argument against synthetic nitrogen because he thought it reduced food soil nutrition. Okay. So here's where the main action is. I just want to make sure that we're clear. You guys should have questions about some of these claims that he's making. So he makes basically five claims about what's wrong with industrial food, and some of these allow digressions to talk about flour and biscuits and things like that. But the main one is from whole foods to refined foods. And here you learn that the culprit, in part, is a process that we all took for granted that happened in the early 20th century, and that was roller mills for grain, for milling grain. And could anybody, could we go to the page for that, and could somebody just try to articulate what's problematic about milling flour with steel or aluminum roller mills? What did we finally achieve when we were able to do that? Let's just kind of see if we can get into that. That's on page, where is that? Let's see. Somebody come up with a page number here. 108?
107,
yeah. 108. Yeah. Let me just try to describe I always get the germ, endosperm stuff confused. So let's just try to dig that out and say it clearly.
What do roller mills do that pollen finds problematic? Take a minute, no rush. Yeah, please.
The big switch was that at first you can only remove the bran,
right?
And then you just have to remove the germ,
right?
And from it, and it sucks a lot of fiber out of the bran itself.
Right. So we're turning a high fiber food into a low fiber food, and what are the trade offs? What do you get for that?
Shelf life.
Yeah. Right. You guys are probably like me. You grew up with the 5-pound flour brick that you buy I never thought of this, but the other authors make this point. I mean, put it in your notes. You don't have to agree with it, but flour is a fresh food. And I just didn't grow up thinking of it as a fresh food. I thought it was a really stable food that you have in the pantry for months and months, and you go get some more flour, and it looks pretty much like it did a month before, you know? But real flour that's been freshly milled lasts about a week or two. It goes bad because the oils go rancid. But once the milling process takes the oils out, you get great shelf life. It still tastes like flour. But here's the comparison you need to do. Get a loaf. I thought about, we could do this in class if you wanted to, but you guys have done this separately. But if you do it side by side, get a loaf of industrial bread. Try something like a generic whole wheat bread even, right? Give the industrial bread all the advantage you can, right? So industrial whole wheat is very different from real whole wheat. Then do Dave's Killer Bread if you want to throw in a third category. And then go downtown to Common Crumb where they bake bread every day, and they buy, I'm pretty sure, we need to get the details on this, they buy freshly milled flour. So they're buying huge quantities of flour that I think, I'm going to find out, this would be a good research thing for any of you too, I think they're buying flour that has a 2-week window, that it was milled within 2 weeks of being used. And just compare the taste of those breads. Compare how they degrade in your mouth, because your saliva is breaking down the bread right from the start. But yeah.
Do majority of bakeries buy fresh flour since they use so much of it, or does it all depend on the bakery?
Well, I think it'd be a good question for the Snyder's folks. My understanding is that artisan bakers, one of the quality advantages that they claim is that they're using fresh bread. But the cheapest flour is going to come from an industrially processed flour mill. So my guess is that Snyder's is full of industrial flour. Now you can add things to flour to make up for that. You can add flavoring agents, you can add whey, you can add all kinds of stuff. But that's the kind of comparison he wants you to make. And you can make it at the taste level, you can make it at the chemistry level, because what do we know about industrial, white flour? How's it going to digest differently than real whole wheat flour from an artisan bakery? It's going to be sugar by the time it gets to your small intestine. It's already, so in other words, white flour, Pollen calls it this way, white flour is our first industrial fast food. And so that bears on the Carl's Jr. biscuits, right? Because sure, the method's scratch, but the flour choice is already an industrial food product that didn't exist in the Old South because they couldn't mill that way. So by definition, even white flour would have been yellow because it would have had some oils in it, and it would have been healthier than industrial white flour. But the deeper question is, why would you not want to eat whole wheat? Anybody give us a culture food culture answer to that? Why would whole wheat flour be looked down upon?
Did they say that the white flour was like, or people that could afford it tend to be richer for the white flour?
It's a delicacy. It takes more labor. Before roller mills, it took more labor to produce white flour, so it was a status. It was, make sure you guys are attentive to both the chemical and culture side of food, right?
Whenever we were at tournaments, our coach would always tell us to have white bread because it was converted to sugar faster. So if we were between games, they didn't want us eating wheat.
Interesting. Yeah, that kind of makes sense if you're going to get out on the field right away. What sport? I'm sorry, I forgot.
Volleyball.
Yeah. Yeah, that kind of makes sense. You want power. And you drink energy drinks during games?
No. They make me kind of nauseous.
Okay. Do some people do that? Or, I mean,
yeah, I mean Gatorade.
Yeah,
but they try to dilute it.
Yeah, good. No, that would be consistent with that. You know, it's basically sugar in another form. Remember the Hardee's biscuit has a quarter cup of sugar added to 12 biscuits, which is a bit of sugar. Okay. Somebody else had a point? Good. I'm glad you guys are bringing stuff forward. So it's the simplification that he uses bread as the paradigmatic example. So what did we do? We fortified the bread with artificial vitamins. But then you get this Jacobs and Stefan study, which is an epidemiological study, which is really a good way to do this. You know, big numbers of people, actual food behaviors, and what's neat about this study is that he compared people getting equivalent nutrients. So it's, you know, it kind of argues for the synergistic effect, the holistic effect, that you can get fortified bread, but you're not getting the same thing. Another side to this story, which we don't need to go into now, is the history of sugar. How many of you have ever run across this in maybe history class? Sugar has a very interesting history, and you could track the amazing increase, like a 2,000% increase in sugar consumption. Just pull up some of the data on it. From like the 1870s when we started making sugar cane in great quantities, and I think there was a particular British, once an embargo was lifted against sugar or some kind of tax, sugar just came flooding into Great Britain and the consumption just went through the roof. And people's teeth rotted. That was one of the issues with the dentistry. Okay. So the second angle is from complexity to simplicity, and we're going to study more about soil in the course. But the argument here is that industrial food simplifies the food product, and it simplifies the soil that the food product's grown in. Because remember, the food itself is just a vehicle for creating a chemical that can be manipulated. So corn and soy, as Pollen points out, corn and soy are some of the most efficient plants for converting sunlight and nitrogen into sugar, basically. So what we want is an agricultural monoculture that allows us to produce those chemicals. We're not interested in sort of the whole plant. We're interested in harvesting the plant to chemically process in an industrial model. Comments on that one? This bleeds over into the other section because both sections actually acknowledge, and this is a good point for your notes. Some of you might want to research this more. That various studies, both by the government and private researchers, that food nutrition has declined since the middle of the 20th century. So low nutrients in the soil, big surprise, low nutrients in the food, right? So get that in your notes, right? There's several independent researchers that have documented the decline in nutrition content. And you can compare, you know, you can compare organically grown food with industrially grown food. I'm sorry, I'm trying to think of there's another point to that. I just lost it, sorry. Oh, right, this is good, this is a good reminder. One of the other things we do So one feature is impoverished soil, degraded food, right? You got that in your notes. The other angle to this, which is really interesting, it's kind of insidious, is consumers like big blemish-free varieties of foods. So think about this. If you can grow a commercial variety of an apple or a carrot, and you can make it bigger, say you can make it 20% bigger, but it's got 10% less nutrients, then what happens? How does that affect the diet? So now to get the same nutrients from that fresh food, you have to eat a bigger volume of that food, right? So you've got this, you know, big commercial variety of a food item. Maybe it's a pear, maybe it's an apple, but it's nutrient, it becomes, the point for your notes is it becomes nutrient, less nutrient dense. So now you're eating a bigger food product that's, so you see the problem? You're having to
consume a larger volume of food to get this to get the nutrients from. And this is from a natural food product. It might be a commercial vegetable or fruit.
So that one, that works to diminish the nutrient density of our diets. But we're willing participants, because when you go to the store, you don't. I mean, the nutrients are invisible. So you look at this little fruit that's an organically grown fruit. It may have higher levels of phytochemicals and more antioxidant effects, but you don't see that. You see a couple of blemishes, and it looks kind of small, and the price is high. Do you see the point? So you go for the prettier looking food. It's less nutrient dense. Price is lower. But it's a kind of false value, because you paid less, but you got less. You got a bigger thing, but you got less nutrient value for that. Okay, yeah.
I remember watching this 20-minute story video about how supermarkets just stock their shelves with all these products, when in reality they'll probably throw half of it away, because they want to be abundant, basically. We have all this food,
right.
All this good stuff, and in reality, just what you said, if there's a bad one, no one's ever going to take it, because there's going to be stocking with fresher ones.
That's a great point. You know, the whole food waste angle is, I can't remember the documentary off the top of my tongue. It's not dumpster diving, but something like that. It's a couple that lived for 6 months off food that was wasted from, does anybody remember the title of that documentary? No. Okay, we'll come across it. Maybe on the food list. And they made this point that, exactly what you're saying, that the industrial food distribution system, the grocery store system, is tilted toward consumers' preferences, whether they're wasteful or not. And what you guys don't want to see the food that's not looking as good. You don't even want to see it on a discount stand. You just don't want to see it. And that is a preference that we have. So our food sensitivities get us into trouble. You can't always blame the government. You can't always blame the industry for that. They're often responding to, consumer preferences. This is the kind of food we want to see. Good. Others? Yeah, please.
That just made me think about talking about the soil and how it's a cycle with the nutrients from the soil, the sun, the plants, the animals, and about how much food waste we throw away every day that goes into landfills and kicks it out of the cycle, basically.
Yeah, right.
It never gets reused.
Right, absolutely, that's a good point.
Some estimates are that food waste is 35 to 40%.
Yeah, it's average American waste 4 pounds a day or something.
It's a practicality issue. Yeah, it's a practicality issue at the level of your individual diets, because you could ask yourself, how much of what I buy and stick in my fridge do I use? Well, part of that's going to be determined by what your diet is and how you time your diet to create food meals from that food, and there's different ways to reduce waste for that. Yeah.
So I used to work at the produce department in Safeway.
Oh, cool. Right.
And we were told that if a food had one blemish in it, just toss it. And they were actually reimbursed for how much they composted. So we had a big compost pile,
good.
And then we wrapped it up and sent it off for a week.
And some Safeway and others also participate in food banks. They will send some of their food, to food banks, especially food that's past its, best by date. So food banks. Often don't have a lot of fresh food, but they have food that is, welcome, cheap calories to people who can't afford food. Yeah. Good comments. If there's others, bring them in. So
this, he indulges a few, he cites a serious researcher, Bruce Ames, but he's in the speculative area of cancer research. I mean, there are nutrition theories of cancer, there are germ theories of cancer. I mean, cancer is just, as some of you know, if you studied kind of biology, cancer is researched in so many different ways, and there are a lot of different theories. But there are clearly cancer increases are one of the features of dietary disease in the Western diet. So it's not unreasonable to wonder if there are micronutrients. One of the major theories is that micronutrients reduce inflammation, and inflammation is a precursor state to cancer formation. It's a very crude way to put it. You see where I'm going with that? So micronutrients include things like phytochemicals. Very recently, only the last 20 years have people talked about phytochemicals. And they're found in natural fruits and vegetables. So that's one of the things you lose when you go to industrial food. Industrial food processes as far as I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, you say anything to the contrary, but industrial food processors do not imitate or cannot fortify food with you can't add phytochemicals. I don't know why that is, but I've never seen a food researcher say that that's something that industrial food can supply. So he's hitting limits, he's hitting structural limits of industrial food here, and that's how he's making the case. Four, okay, we can move on. And four is actually, you know, a big area here. And this is, I was trying to tempt some of you with this this book, The Queen of Fats, last time, which gets into the omega-3 and omega-6 controversy. And we're going to study this more in detail when we study fats in the nutrition textbook. Can anybody, let's take a minute, go to the text here, and see if you can get a couple of the basic idea behind the connection between the transition from leaves to seeds and the transition from high omega-3 fat profile foods to high omega-6 fat profile foods. Can we just zoom in on that together? I think it's right about a little bit before, 129 is where it ends, I think. Could we just kind of browse that together and then reproduce that together? Oh, right, he mentions the Queen of Fats there on 125. I think he does a very compressed job at the top of 126 giving you the kind of the theory in a nutshell, and I don't know how well that's going to communicate just getting one paragraph like that, but the idea is that omega-3 foods with high omega-3 profiles affect cell metabolism of glucose and the permeability of cell membranes, and that permeability is linked with reduced inflammation. Okay, can we get that? Can I do that one more time for your notes? High omega-3 foods are associated with better metabolism of glucose, which means less of an insulin response, less of a spiked insulin response in the glucose, and permeability of cell membranes, which is related to reducing inflammation in cells. Again, there's kind of this inflammation theory of cancer that's underlying this claim. So if omega-3 profiled fats, that's fats that are more predominantly unsaturated, polyunsaturated, and we'll study these at a more chemical level. If omega-3 fats are better for you, why aren't they in industrial food by nature? Make sure we got to have this in your notes. It's a good thing to know. So why would industrial food favor omega-6 fat profile foods over, yeah?
Does it go back to longer shelf life?
Yeah, absolutely. Omega-3 fats are less stable. But it's also connected with choosing oils, seed oils. Two factors there. If you choose seed oils indiscriminately, you're going to wind up with high omega-6 seed oils. One thing you could do as an exercise would be to go on a nutrition site and compare different seed oils, corn oil, safflower oil, you know, give me some more seed oils. Olive oil is not a seed oil, right? Olive oil comes from squeezing the plant. What? What?
Now they have avocado oil.
Avocado oil, right. So oils from squeezing the vegetable are different from oils from squeezing the seed, as far as I understand. So canola, grape seed oil, it's a delicacy. I bought some because I thought it was being a fancy gourmand, you know. Grape seed oil is really bad for omega-6 profile. So if you go on a nutrition site, you can see not oil. I had a little chart somewhere. Maybe I could find it for you. I think it was in the 2015 U.S. Dietary Guidelines. There's a nice chart showing the different oils by their omega-6, omega-3 profiles. Maybe I'll find that. Okay, so that's a pretty hot theory these days. Maybe you'd look for people who are skeptical about omega-3, omega-6 theories, but I haven't seen a lot of cold water being thrown on it. We tend to get into diet nutritional fads, so it's tempting to, you know, get on a bandwagon about these omega-3 fats, but they're not going to solve all our problems, but it's part of the indictment against industrial food, because it's one of the reasons why an industrial food producer would favor a fat profile that isn't good for you. It's good for them, it's not good for you. Okay. Five is what made me think to bring the Artusi book and to mention the Art of Cooking and other kind of national cookbooks that help define national food cultures. Under five, the main thing for your notes is just that Pollan argues that we gave up a lot of traditional knowledge that was embedded in ethnic food cultures, and we let scientists, maybe for good reasons and bad reasons both, we let scientists tell us to set aside traditional food knowledge because it was pre-scientific, and you know, and how reliable was it anyway? And the joke is that 21st century nutrition science is coming back to rediscover the wisdom of traditional food cultures. So one prompt for you guys, if you want to rediscover your ethnic food culture, or if you want to document it, whatever, we have a lot of different ethnicities represented, I remember from the introductory comments and from things you guys have said, would be to go back and discover your Artusi, your Betty Crocker, your Joy of Cooking. What in your ethnic culture actually defines that form of food, whether it's German or Polish or Chilean or, you know, whatever it is, you know, what is it in your ethnic food culture that defines a traditional healthy eating pattern, or just a traditional pattern? Because not all traditional food cultures are healthy. So I think that's kind of an interesting exercise to go into. Okay. Let's take a 2-minute break. Seems like maybe just go stretch your legs, check your messages, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about Marion Nestle. And I'll make sure I've got some details into the story. So 2 or 3 minutes. She's got two potential experiences to offer you, where you would come to her industrial kitchen and you'd basically get a little bit of a talk about nutrition, and it'd be like a cooking class. You'd make a nutritious meal, take it home with you, eat that one there, and maybe take one home with you. And so she has two experiences like that we've been kind of talking about how to craft, and then you could do them along with a journal, and you could do like a 5% journaling experience with that if you wanted to. But that would be something you would add on, and she would be offering that to you, you know, if you're interested in. And when we were meeting, she was telling me about this interesting local entrepreneur, Core Greens, which is doing this container approach to farming, which is kind of weird. I just thought I'd share this with you. So what they're trying to do is a version of what you might call vertical farming or urban farming, where you use pretty industrial methods. Okay, so we're going to want to ask whether Pollan's critique of industrial food applies to all forms of industrial food, because there are some creative, whether they're sustainable or whether they're really good directions, creative ways that people are using hydroponics and industrial technology to grow healthy food. And one of the cool attractions here is that you can put this food in, you can grow this food in the middle of winter efficiently in a tractor trailer. It's not aesthetically, it doesn't appeal to me. But what you're doing is you're using LED lighting, and they found that I'll play the video for you. It's just a 2-minute video. So this guy's doing this in containers, but the people he's really admiring are, so here's his Facebook page. Oh, no, I don't have a Facebook. If you go to Facebook and you look up Cora Greene, you'll get some detailed pictures about his project. But what they tout it as is a way to deliver fresh green vegetables profitably in climates that like this right now, you know, without trucking from California. So when you look at the equation, the sustainability equation, it looks kind of goofy at first because you're saying, wow, you're going to put all this energy into a tractor trailer in the middle of winter in the Northwest. That doesn't sound promising, right? You hear me? You know, I mean, how are you going to recover from that, you know, heating up this container? But it's intensive farming, and the claim is that if you pick your crop right, you know, it can be a cool thing to do. So
Verizon customer service.
I have a contract with you that says I can't go over my data limit.
Let me pull up your information.
Yeah. You can skip. There it is. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, so I just ate a bunch of bugs. It's not bad. We looked at meat made from plant protein, but what about the plants themselves?
That's what I was wondering. What's their future like?
Yeah. Great minds think alike.
What we're seeing now is a climate change issue that's severely affecting agriculture outdoors. We're seeing urbanization like crazy, and we're seeing an increase in human populations. You put those three things together, and you've got another, I hate to use this cliche because everybody's using it now, but it's a perfect storm for disaster.
This is Dixon Depalmier, emeritus professor at Columbia University. He helped develop...
One connection between the readings I wanted to make was that pollen is telling the story about those early 20th century figures who were starting to notice that food cultures, that non-U.S. food cultures didn't have diseases, right? The same diseases. And in the Nestle chapter, you also get a throwback to history, to the first USDA efforts to monitor the food supply. And this is 1862. This goes way back in our history. To monitor the food supply and to monitor people's eating habits. So these are efforts that predate the discovery of vitamins. I think that's really important in our thinking about food, is to get the timing of different things right. So So she's telling a food history that overlaps a bit with pollen's history, but she's more interested. She's into government policy, and so she's had experience with that. So she's more interested in telling the government policy story. So what you get here is the story of the origin of the government food groups. Some history about how we thought about those and how they connected with our national history. And so she's telling a story that about our political food culture that reaches further back into history than we've gone before. And so she's still documenting, so what you're getting here for your notes is she's documenting this, what she called really nutritional transition, in the intro, right, which is how a culture transitions from food scarcity to food abundance, to food overabundance, and she gets that into a slogan with this contrast between eat more and eat less. So what I want to do in the time we have is just hit a couple of key points of that for your notes, and so you can kind of start to get this picture in your head. So if you look, a lot of this story is told with 1977 as a pivot point. Why is that? Anybody? You know this by now, right? McGovern Committee, right? And so this is kind of the pivot point, because up to that point we've had we had several factors that affected the eat more, that promoted eat more, right? We had historic malnutrition up to and including mid-20th century. We had a kind of patriotic food campaign during the war. Eat, get strong because we need to fight the enemy. Get strong to kind of help the troops. We also had a war on poverty, right? In which we discovered, right, as is President Johnson, right, 1964, We or maybe a little bit before that, we discovered that 33% of the country was in poverty, and poverty was determined by an estimate of nutrition of diet. So that kind of that was again a factor with Eat More, because the approach was that if people weren't getting their RDAs, the government was going to say, well, just eat more and that'll cover it. But notice, we're in this transition period. We're not in the 1950s. We're not overweight. We're just starting to move into food abundance. And then she covers this period from the 70s, really to the late 80s. And this is a transitional period during which part of the story already, right? You get the pushback from the McGovern Committee's initial draft, which was to recommend eating less. And so you start to get this ideological language where we have to finesse eat less with eat more lean, right? Do you remember the way the language gets abused here? Instead of reduce consumption of meat, we get choose meats. So the point for your notes is we always translate reduction. During this transition period, we're always translating eat less into eat more healthy things. And the way, it's kind of interesting, isn't it? And then the way this was reflected in our diet was we just raised the total calories per day. So we just started, we ate the stuff we like to eat, and then the government said, well, eat more lean meat. So we added lean meat. we just kept eating the stuff that we thought it was okay to keep eating. So we didn't get, reduce intake doesn't come until there's this consensus. So from nutritionists, and she reports it that way, until you get this kind of consensus among nutritionists in the late 80s, you don't get maintain ideal weight, reduce intake. So that's the transition to eat less. And what's interesting about it is she said by the late 80s, the food industry stopped resisting, right? Now let's connect this in your notes. Remember Pollan's story about nutritionism. He has an answer for why the food industry stopped resisting. Does anybody remember what it was? Why did the industry get on board with government nutrition advice? Yeah, so the theory of nutritionism, make sure it's in your notes, the theory of nutritionism comes into play here. She doesn't cite it, but she does make the point that industry stopped resisting the eat less message because it became a cause for marketing. Okay, here's some low-fat foods. Choose more low-fat foods. Well, you're still at 3,500 calories, you're still at 4,000 calories a day, but now you're choosing more of our products. And so if everybody's worried about low fat, you got the lipid hypothesis, you guys could write about that. So if everybody's choosing, the short answer is industry stopped resisting because nutritionism explains why industry stopped resisting. Because in the ideology of nutritionism, nutrients become occasions for marketing, right? If you can manipulate the nutrients, you just pick the nutrient fat of the day. And now there are products that are advertised. How many of you have seen products that advertise omega-3 oils? Right? Now we're starting to find a way to get omega-3 oils in there. I don't know how they do that chemically because they are more unstable, so I would like to know more about that. But you can see the industry is playing that game, and it's a great game for building sales, but it hasn't really, so the point for your notes is that the reduce, maintain ideal weight message hasn't worked because it's part of a system where we continue to tell people to eat more, even though the consensus among nutritionists is to eat less. Okay. The summary at the end is really good, and that kind of puts together what we've just been going over. Okay. So now I think we've consolidated. We're kind of at a point now, if you just kind of look at where we are in the course, where we've consolidated most of a critique of, let me just kind of get you the reading schedule so you see where we're going. We have two more classes, and Jenny visits right when we're finishing our first in-depth unit. So we're really kind of starting a deeper look now with this class and the next two at the indictment against industrial food, but also we're gonna read section 3 of Pollan's book, which is really kind of the longest food advice we've gotten, the longest dietary advice we've gotten. So if you're thinking about doing any of the diet review exercises, section 3 of In Defense of Food is probably the best short, for my money, the best short representation of the consensus that Nestle was referring to among nutritionists that occurred in the late 80s. Okay? Let's break there. See you guys on Thursday.